everyone. It's Wednesday, hump day, October 23rd. Lucky you, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Now, it was wet this morning. It was clearing up when I came in, but I've been in the studio taping a show for Friday already. But we had a special edition from Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, so we had to grab him now. And I'm wondering, is it still beautiful out there? Or is it?
Yeah.
It is. It's gorgeous. I tell you, yesterday I went apple picking. I am being such a good New Hampshire person. You know, I tell everyone to do this, you know, and then I don't do it myself. And I suddenly realize, how can I send my guests to do all this stuff and then never having done it myself? So I'm
tripping. You should make some money in the Department of Tourism.
I should. I am so good for this state, I tell you. You don't know what you have.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, darling. Now, everyone is talking about the amazing testimony that took place the other day and how, you know, poor – I mean, do I feel bad for Donald Trump? No. Here's what I feel bad for him is that when they replaced the Ukrainian ambassador, they replaced the Ukrainian ambassador with someone who had even more history in the bureaucracy, who even had more knowledge of Ukraine, who really actually hated Russia, who, you know, had such a level of history and knowledge that he brought to the – and he loved the Ukrainian people. So that replacement was so – actually, from our perspective, very smart. From his perspective, very stupid. Because this guy was going to keep copious notes, and he knew when he saw things that were wrong. And all he could see was wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong. And he wanted to make sure that he could accurately represent it when someone asked the question. And he delivered.
Yeah.
I tell you,
that?
Facts actually matter, even to Donald Trump.
Some people actually take facts into account.
Can you imagine?
Oh, my.
How do the rabid GOP followers of Donald Trump raise their children? No, I'm serious.
Interesting.
And no, I want to know how they teach their children. That's a really important question. Do you teach your children to share? Do you teach your children to lie? Do you teach? I mean, what do you?
Be
what,
nice to your neighbors, regardless of who they are and what they look like.
Do you teach your children to swear in public? I want to know what they teach their children.
How do you teach your little? What do you teach your little boys about what to do with little girls?
I'm telling you. Has anyone ever sat down with them and said, the behaviors that you are seeing now, for whatever reason, you were looking the other way from the president of the United States? What kind of behaviors do you teach your children?
Yeah.
I want to know. Anyway,
so,
on that note.
Speaking of presidents, I am going to talk about a different president.
There was
an election in Canada.
We're going to talk about that tomorrow.
And guess who won, sort of? Well, according to Justin Trudeau, it was a mandate for his continuing to rule and give his progressive policies. And the Canadians rejected division and negativity and – it turned out that he is no longer a majority leader, but he will lead the country as prime minister, but he has a minority government. He doesn't have a majority of the legislature, and so he won't be able to pass any legislation.
Well, he's going to have to cobble together some kind of ruling majority.
Compromise
but
a lot.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
He just wasn't able to message to the voters that he had earned another majority.
Right.
But the voters, on the other hand, weren't ready, didn't want to cast their futures in the hands of the right-wing party.
Right, exactly.
It was kind of like our 2016 election in some ways. It was voters going to the polls, holding their nose and picking what they viewed as the lesser of two evils. And I don't know how it's going to work out, but probably not well. His scandals and his missteps really hurt him. He had an easy win 4 years ago, promising to be a progressive alternative to the conservatives. And then he gets into office and, having advertised himself as an environmental advocate and self-declared feminist who named a gender-diverse cabinet and welcomed refugees, he wound up supporting a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar pipeline right after he said he was an environmentalist. He paraded around, took photo ops that embarrassed Canadians who are, unlike our president, Canadians are sort of normal and don't want to just show off. They don't think being a peacock is a good way to lead their country.
Well, there's a concept of fraternité that does not exist in the United States. We're much more me, myself, and I. We much more embrace the idea of the individual, and they embrace the idea of the community.
Yeah.
And that really has consequences for policy. And you see it with what happened. But I just wanted, did you hear the story, though, that Trudeau wins by this tiny margin, and he breaks into the announcement by the conservative leader, who is basically saying, you know, we lost, in his concession speech, instead of allowing him the time to do the concession speech, Trudeau makes his announcement at the same time to Trump. That it's never been seen in Canadian history that a prime minister would do something so déclassé, is what they said. And yeah. People were actually offended by that.
Yeah,
I mean,
that.
You respect – even the loser gets respect.
Yeah.
And what Trudeau did was so un-Canadian. Un-Canadian.
Well, especially if the loser was actually conceding and
yes.
not claiming that
yes.
there was something fraudulent about the election. But then Trudeau had this ethics problem over the summer. Ethics watchdog decided that he had violated conflict of interest laws because he pressured the former attorney general
right.
to make a deal with an engineering firm.
Yeah.
And then the
blackface, remember, a couple of
yes,
times?
Yes, but even before that, the attorney general was the first indigenous attorney general and a woman. And
yeah, pressure.
She was moved out of her role and demoted because she dared to disagree with him. Sounds like somebody we know. And then you have the brown face and black face.
Oh, my God.
You can't really
and he couldn't
explain
remember
that
how,
away.
And he couldn't remember how many times. That was the other thing. But
yeah.
you know what his ace in the hole was. Barack Obama came out and endorsed him the week before. Did you know this? Yeah, just to let you know, outside influence from another nation, just as we're talking,
huh,
I'm just saying.
I mean,
he wasn't
that.
President. He's an ex-president. But Barack Obama, the week before, basically endorsed Justin Trudeau. So I just thought I would lay that on the table too.
Yeah, and so that means that Trudeau can't brag about being sensitive to diversity and inclusion and all of that because he has one – I have one black friend.
Yeah, no. That's probably not true. But so Steve Paikin's joining us tomorrow.
Yes.
By the way, just to let you know, so Steve Paikin is the host of TV Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
He is also the host of a show on TV Ontario called The Agenda. And this is, I think, the first year in a long time that he hasn't moderated the debates between the leading party members who are vying to be prime minister. So he got to sit on the sidelines and watch. But he will do a tremendous amount of cleanup, and not just about what just happened, but moving forward, where the hell are they going to go? It's frightening.
But and the future is tenuous because there is rising populism and right-wing populism in Canada that almost defeated
right.
him.
Right.
He's the bulwark now between them rising to ascendancy in less than 4 years or four
mm-hmm,
years.
Mm-hmm.
He might not make it to 4 years. And
he might have another election next year, everyone. There's the potential for that. That's what I'm hearing. So just to let you know.
He might win or
– Well, we'll see what happens. It's going to be – governing is hard, everyone. I'm just telling you right now. Governing is hard.
Okay.
Speaking of governing, impeachment is hard too because we're going to be talking with a professor from the Rochester Institute of Technology about what happens when impeachment comes to the Senate. But before we do that, I want to share with you a little story that I saw at the Christian Science Monitor. And, you know, I always pick these random stories. Some of them I get angry about, but some of them are charming. And this one is interesting. So here is how I framed it. He is not kidding. From sucking up dust bunnies to lionfish, I swear to God, the latest weapon against the lionfish invasion in the ocean, meet the Roomba of the sea. Now, there's a couple of reasons why this story would catch my eye. When iRobot first came out with Roomba a couple of years ago, guess who was their first radio interview? Little old me. I had seen this tiny little squib, and I decided to call the company up, and I actually was their first media interview when they were sort of marketing the idea of that Roomba, that vacuum cleaner that, you know, is self-motivated and goes under your couch. Anyway, I saw this story, and I'm going to recommend that everyone go to the Christian Science Monitor or go to my Facebook page for The Attitude and read it. It is absolutely fascinating, and it's also fascinating because I really was not aware of the lionfish. The lionfish is horrific. It is, as they describe it, the perfect invader. The perfect invader. And it really is so destructive to the diversity of coral reefs. This is what they say. They can eat fish up to half their body size, and a single lionfish can eat dozens of fish in a day. No native species prey on the lionfish, so you're not losing very many of them over the course of time. They can lay up to 2 million eggs a year. Now, listen to this. But they are impervious to predation since they are housed in an inedible sac. Once lionfish are established in an area, it is very difficult to get rid of them, and they can quickly destroy much of a reef's biodiversity. Lionfish can strip a reef, everyone, of 90% of its juvenile fish in as little as 5 weeks. And what comes to the rescue is that the inventor of the Roomba happens also to be a diver. He learned about the lionfish. He went back to his team and said, I want you to develop a submersible robot that can descend to great depths to gather lionfish. And from there, the Guardian was born. You've got to hear this story about the Roomba of the sea. Only Arnie Arneson would do something quite so insane, but you know how it is. All right. We have been spending a lot of time, everyone, talking about impeachment. But most of our focus has been on what? It has been on what is happening in the House of Representatives. But that is just the beginning of the story. Once they've made the decision to impeach, it then moves over to the Senate. And of course, what we know is Nancy Pelosi does not control the Senate. Who controls the Senate is, some have called him Putin's puppet, but his other name is Mitch McConnell. And I saw a piece at theconversation.com, and I hope that my professor, from associate professor of political science at the Rochester Institute of Technology, will forgive me, but I'm going to start with the editor's note because it really does set the stage, Professor Burns, for your, I think, wonderful and informative Q&A that you did about the five things that we need to know as this impeachment trial eventually does land in the Senate. And here is the editor's note. If the House of Representatives concludes its impeachment inquiry, which I suspect it will, by passing articles of impeachment of President Donald Trump, attention will turn to the Senate. Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, is known as, quote, master of the Senate rules. That is the most important language here. Understand, this is not about the Constitution. This is going to be more about something called the Senate rules. And he has been raising campaign donations with ads touting the power he would have over impeachment. Constitutional scholar Sarah Burns, our next guest, from the Rochester Institute of Technology, answers some crucial questions. So I want to welcome to the program Professor Burns, and I thank you so much for doing this. It was so clear, and it held my hand, and it turns out I think the rules are everything. So welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's literally go through, Sarah, the five Q&As that you'd answer, because I think it's really important. Just to let you know, one of the comments that you made in your piece, I actually was just talking to John Nichols of The Nation magazine, and I read him a paragraph, and he said, I've got to write a whole column about that. So just to let you know, you have now feeding other columns around the country.
Wonderful.
It is wonderful. So let's begin with the first one. Will the Senate even take up a House impeachment? So let's understand the rhetoric of Mitch McConnell and the reality of what ultimately could possibly happen, given the idea that, as I pointed out, the rules are so important.
Yes, yeah, so it's true that the rules are very important, and the rules are created by the Senate themselves.
Exactly.
And they've progressed over time and been developed because the Constitution is very vague about what it means once impeachment proceedings have begun. And so in this instance, it's entirely true that based on the Senate rules as they are currently written, the Senate is compelled to receive the articles. So they are unable to have any way around literally having the prosecutors from the House coming to the Senate. After that point, however, there's lots of things that they can do in order to circumvent their constitutional duties to really have a fair and free trial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really interesting aspect of the Senate rules as they currently exist.
So one of the things, for example, in the current rules as they exist today, which can be changed by a majority, of which the Republicans control the majority tomorrow.
Oh, actually, it's a supermajority to formally change the rules.
So wait a minute.
But there's even a way around that.
Yeah, so tell me what the way around. So that's what I thought. All right. So, for example, right now the rules say that you have 24 hours to proceed to consideration of such articles and must continue until they reach a final judgment. So if you need a supermajority to change the rules, then you somehow explained that there was a way around that with a simple majority. So since we're here, like, we want to learn the technicalities of this so we can watch it. What is the simple majority approach to changing the supermajority approach? I want people to understand that what you see may not be what you get.
Yes, exactly. And that's part of why it's so great to be a master of these kinds of rules, and
exactly.
Why it's so hard for the rest of us when we're looking at the plain reading of the constitutional text or the plain reading even
exactly.
of the Senate rules. It doesn't quite come forward. So it's really good to try and dig into these subtleties as they exist. So essentially what happens is in order to have a formal change of the rules, as I mentioned, you have to have two-thirds agreement in the Senate. However, what they can do is they can ask, for example, for Roberts, who would be, so John Roberts would be the one presiding.
The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court presides over the impeachment trial, yes.
Okay, right. Keep going. Impeachment of the president, yes. Right. And so he's presiding, and any senator can say, well, you know, we're wondering whether or not these rules or whether we should even take up the impeachment proceedings. And as long as they don't then call for a formal change to the rules, even if Robert says, you do have to take the trial, you do have to do this, they can overrule him with just a simple majority.
Let me step back.
I know.
This is so crazy. But no, actually, this is like chess. I love it.
I know.
So this is really important because, again, being a master of the rules means he can say something to the public, he can say something on Fox, and then he can do exactly the opposite, only he's still playing by the quote-unquote rules. So you're telling me that the rules say you need a supermajority and that the rules say that you have to do this within 24 hours. So then you bring in the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court to conduct it. He then says he's following the rules, and then you can say to the Chief Justice, we don't like what you do, but by a simple majority, they can prevent him from doing it?
They can say, so because the Chief Justice is the procedural head, so he's the one who's deciding how the procedure will go, any senator, however, can ask him to alter the proceedings. And so, like, the biggest thing they could do is say, we're not even going to look at impeachment. And Chief Justice Roberts can then say, no, based on the constitutional text and based on my interpretation of the law, which is entirely valid, you are required by the Constitution and by your own rules to take this up and continue to engage with the proceedings until you reach a conclusion.
At that point, a single senator could then say, no, I want to challenge that, and all they then need is a simple majority.
Correct, yes.
This is so evil. Okay, all right, but rules are crucial here, everyone. This is why I loved your article. Okay, now that I've gotten through that first question, let's go to the second one. Once it's part of the Senate's business, who is in charge? And I kept thinking that, you know, Justice Roberts, you know, respects process, he respects the Constitution, but what you just told me from, you know, answering the first question is making me a little bit nauseous because in some ways, I feel like, does he have control over anything? Or is he a master puppeteer in the sense that he won't be, the master will be the Senate and Mitch McConnell, and he'll just sort of be sitting in the seat saying, this is what we should do, and they'll go, no, not that. This is what we should do, no, not that. Or will he use his position of authority and almost bully pulpit to shame them into not somehow restricting him?
That's a very good question, and it's one of those aspects of impeachment that's really interesting because it's this convoluted and complicated political and legal process.
Yes.
So obviously to take a minute to go back to the founders, right, we separated the powers out. We have the legislative, executive, and judicial powers, but we allowed some of the powers to kind of intermingle. Right. And so the impeachment power is a perfect example of that, where it's technically a legal power because the senators are judging whether or not someone has committed impeachable offenses. Mm-hmm. And then the reason you have the Chief Justice there for the president is because, you know, it's the highest level and you don't want the vice president to be have dual loyalty, right? And not be able to preside very effectively. Right. So that's why you have the Chief Justice when it's the president. However, because it's still in the political arena and because there's still political rules that kind of apply to it, and I mean sort of informal rules, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's a lot of control that the Senate gets to hold within their own body. And so it would be very, very hard for Chief Justice Roberts to overrule and push his understanding of the procedure forward and require the Senate to, for example, honor a subpoena by the prosecutors if they didn't want to honor a subpoena, or alternatively, if they wanted to introduce evidence that was frankly hearsay in a normal criminal proceeding, they could still do that and overrule him and say, no, we're going to introduce hearsay evidence because they're really in control
This is the illusion of a juror and the illusion of a judge. Because what juror can dictate to a judge what to do? What juror can dictate to a judge and overrule the judge? Technically, you assume the judge is like the master conductor, you know, that they control the process.
Yeah.
And this now is like fudge. I mean, you know, well, everyone has a title, but nobody actually has a job because they can actually eclipse the other's job. And that's what's so scary about this. Ken Barnes told me.
Can I ask you a question, Sarah?
Sure.
I understand that any senator can ask Roberts to go back to the simple majority or can challenge his decision about going back to a simple majority. But what about a second senator asking Roberts to make a legal ruling? Because he's the presiding judge, right, in this proceeding. Judges decide legal questions, and he could make a legal ruling that it's violating the Constitution or a statute to change the rules this way and to not proceed the way the Constitution requires. In other words, the first senator is asking him to make a political decision, essentially, and the second senator, the Democrat, let's say, would be asking him to make a legal ruling as the presiding judge that refuses to accept what the first senator is voting on for by majority.
Well, it's best to see the senators in this situation in an impeachment setting. They're not the jury per se. They're more like a collection of 100 judges.
Exactly.
And then Roberts is in control of the procedural questions. So it's true that he's sort of like the, I don't want to use any terms here, insofar as he's supposed to be the one with the most knowledge about legal rules, then in theory people are supposed to defer to his understanding about procedure. So it's only procedure that he has real control over.
Mm. However, isn't this real procedure?
But the real procedure would be that every senator has the capacity to introduce evidence or try and deny the process of even looking at the impeachment proceedings, or alternatively, they can try and call witnesses that have nothing really to do with the trial itself. And
just to muddy the waters.
Exactly. So Justice Roberts can very easily say that's unnecessary. These witnesses shouldn't be called. There's no need for them. But as long as they don't change the formal rules, with a simple majority, the senators can do that. Now, it's true that, as you say, a Democrat or someone else, right, who just doesn't like people playing so much politics with this proceeding, there's a possibility that they could then make an objection and try and get Roberts to retry the rule, but they would still have to get a majority to agree. Right. It's not a supermajority.
Let me just say something. But this is all happening, everyone, in public. So everybody gets to see the machinations, the playing, the whatever. And there is some benefit from, you know, the Chief Justice saying this would be my ruling, and then having, you know, some bozo in the U.S. Senate who's also, as you mentioned, both a judge and a jury, basically trying to sort of change that. So what is the expectation from the Constitution? What is the expectation from a legal ruling? What is the expectation of all this? Is looking like it's being manipulated for a pure political reason, not to get to justice, but basically to muddy the waters. So in the end, the senator might win, but it's really a black eye for the process, because what you've got is the chief judge saying, this is really what we should be doing. And then you've got some hack who basically says, well, I don't want to play by those rules. I want to make up my own rules. So I think there is, and I think Mitch McConnell understands it. Yes, he can be a master of the rules. Yes, he can be effective. Yes, he can be lethal. But is there more benefit for being fair than there is for trying to manipulate the outcome and muddying it so you never really get to a result?
I think, and the problem is, because this is all developing so quickly, and because, you know, there's news, I mean, I can't even, you know, keep track of it myself, let alone trying to explain it to my students.
Yep.
There's so much happening every single day, and so I think his calculations have to be sort of clicking back and forth of, you know, supporting the president seems like a good idea, regardless of whether or not we have to do some fancy footwork or undermining the process to a certain extent in order to do it. Or alternatively, no, it makes more sense now to stay above board, be very constitutional, like, you know, don the robe of the very constitutional actor, which he can perfectly well do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends really where he ends up falling by the time, you know, if the House actually draws up the articles of impeachment.
Which is why I love what you wrote, because, and we're going to get you back because we have to like end this interview and I want to go through the rest of the three. And what I think is so important is this is threading a very difficult needle for him, because everything is so fluid. So is there more value at this point for him to think that he wants to slow it down? Maybe not. Is there more value in moving quickly? Maybe yes. And of course, for him, it is going to be a very political decision whether he slows it down or moves it quickly. But because things are changing so much, it is so easy for him to make a mistake right now. I mean, that's
really
what I think.
Is,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't feel bad for him, but at the same time, I want people to understand he has tremendous power. But with that tremendous power and that tremendous latitude comes the potential for making a huge mistake because he can't blame anyone but himself.
Yes. Yeah, that's entirely true, because he really does at this point also have a fairly cohesive party. I mean, not perfectly cohesive as
right.
we used to understand it, but all the same, if you look at most of the senators now will kind of follow in his lead, and he's had so much power for so much time and is so masterful in the way he engages in the political process that I think he can get a decent amount of unity within his party. So whichever direction he ends up going, I think he'll bring the Republican Party with him for good or ill.
Right. right.
And so...
And right now he's got a precarious situation because the president is now, I mean, there so many things are happening. I said to John Nichols of The Nation magazine, it's synergistic. You know, each one of these things were problematic, but all of them happening simultaneously at the same time is making
right.
everyone, I think, feeling so unnerved, and there is no stable ground. And so while Mitch McConnell may right. be a master of the rules, in this situation, the rules don't anticipate the kind of nuclear situation that Donald Trump is presenting to him. This is not a clear-cut impeachment like what you saw with Nixon, like what you saw with Clinton. There is no past experience that one can look to in order to give you some idea of a reference point as you're moving forward, which is why this is both so exciting and so frightening. I got to tell everyone, you've got to go read Sarah Byrne's fabulous piece at theconversation.com. She's an associate professor of political science at Rochester Institute of Technology. If impeachment comes to the Senate, 5 questions answered. I wish I was taking a course with you, Sarah. You're a fabulous teacher. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone, a little labor history is next, and then we're talking about a new book with another professor of law. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1995. That was the day that the AFL-CIO convention convened in New York City. At the convention, John Sweeney was elected president of the Federation. It was the first contested election for president in AFL-CIO history. He ran with a slate of labor leaders, including Rich Trumka, who called themselves the New Voice Slate. Sweeney was president of the Service Employees International Union. He was a New Yorker born in the Bronx. He started his career in labor working for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, then moving to SEIU as a union rep. He represented SEIU Local 32B in New York City during 2 strikes of apartment maintenance workers during the 1970s. In 1980, he was elected president of the International SEIU, a post he held for 15 years. Membership in SEIU nearly doubled from 625,000 to 1.1 million under his leadership. Sweeney gave a powerful speech for his candidacy at the convention. He said, quote, "Workers look at their paychecks, the political system, and the public debate and wonder why nobody is speaking for me. Then, in fear and frustration, they look for leadership to the Rush Limbaughs who seek scapegoats rather than solutions for problems of stagnant wages, corporate greed, and a fractured society." He pledged that under his leadership, the AFL-CIO would move to commit more resources to organizing these workers. When he won election, Sweeney held good to his campaign promise. He instituted a new initiative, the Union Summer Program, to involve college students in the labor movement. He expanded organizing efforts in the South and Southwest. John Sweeney served 5 terms as president of the AFL-CIO. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In coastal Louisiana, rising seas and heavier rainfall can flood homes and neighborhoods. From the Ninth Ward of New Orleans to towns along the bayous, low-income communities of color face some of the greatest threats. But they are often excluded from conversations about climate policy.
They are seeing the impacts, but may not have the jargon or like specific language and tools that decision makers are using.
Caressa Chester is with the Foundation for Louisiana, which offers a leadership development program called Lead the Coast. Participants learn the science of global warming and how it is having local impacts. They discuss how race, power, and privilege influence policy. And they join a supportive community of new leaders.
It offers them a space to share information, sharpen skills, exchange knowledge and build pathways to leadership roles and positions.
Chester says some participants have gone on to form nonprofits in their communities, and one even testified before Congress about the impacts of climate change.
So they're equipped with all of the knowledge and information possible in order to be as effective as possible and to build their own power and confidence in having those conversations.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Save the world.
That's destined to
that
die.
That is destined to die.
When I look at the world.
When I look at the world.
It fills me with sorrow.
It fills me with sorrow.
Little children today.
Children today.
Really gonna suffer tomorrow.
Really suffer tomorrow.
Oh, what a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to live.
Such a bad way to live.
Who is to blame?
Who is to blame?
We can't stop
when
living.
We can't stop living. Oh, oh.
Live.
Live.
Live. Live.
Live for life. Live for life.
But let live, everybody.
Live life for the children.
Live.
All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. And, of course, you know Ken picks our music. And the name of the song was Save the Children By...
And it's Marvin Gaye, one of the all-time greats and yeah. A man with a lot of heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is a book, that's, I think, based on a lot of heart as well, a lot of concern about saving the children. And it's a perfectly appropriate song to have chosen. Joining us in studio is Leah Plunkett. She serves on the youth and media team of researchers at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. She also is a professor at UNH Law. She has a new book that has come out. It's entitled Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. And before I bring Leah in, I was sent a number of people who have written, you know, complimentary thoughts about having read the book. And the one that I actually want to focus on was written by Dorothy Fortenberry. She is the writer-producer for The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. And here's what she wrote about Leah's book. In Sharenthood, Leah Plunkett deftly explores the challenges inherent in raising children in the digital age from the unique perspective of a legal scholar. Rather than fear-mongering about what anonymous bad guys might do to our children, she notes what we, ourselves, as parents already are doing every day, often for no reward greater than likes. The book is a bracing and provocative look at the present and a prescient warning about our potential futures. Let me welcome to the program Leah Plunkett. Thank you so much for joining us, Leah.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, so what was the motivation for this book? Was it because you were working at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society and you saw all this massive information coming in and you suddenly saw things that said, wow, this is painting a picture? But it's a picture we are not necessarily familiar with. And if you're not prepared, you're not going to be armed to understand how to protect the thing that is the most valuable thing to you, which is your child.
Absolutely. It was a dual motivation. In my role as a researcher, I was very, very focused going back to 2013 on student data privacy in particular. That was how I started at the Berkman Klein Center. We were very focused on looking at educational technology providers and how they were entering schools and what data they were taking about kids. And so I started looking at educational technologies, and then I went, as you just said, Arnie, kind of, holy moly, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And then the other prong of the motivation was when I started at the Berkman Klein Center, I was the parent of a then 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. I am now the parent of an almost 9-year-old mm-hmm. and a 4.5-year-old, and my dog, who's the elder statesman, he's almost 11. But it was a combination of being a legal researcher in the digital privacy space and being a mom of young kids and realizing, mm-hmm. oh, I have some pictures of my kids on Facebook. Oh, I am liking this post on Instagram about a friend's kids. And that feels great in the moment because we're all busy and it's a way for me to connect each day. But also, is this really a good thing? Is it okay?
Well, so as I'm listening to you, you know what's going through my head? What's going through my head is Michelle and Barack Obama. Mm. And why that's going through my head is they were so neurotic about protecting the privacy of their children. They were so concerned about that because they understood they needed to protect them for a lot of reasons. But I think you kind of go, oh, that's the president. That's not me. And I think why your book is so important is that what you reveal is not only what we think we're doing, which is not harmful, but we've never played out the consequences of our actions. And one in part because we didn't realize the consequences of our actions. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm a Luddite. I don't really I'm late to Facebook. I've never done Instagram. I don't know any of this crap. So in a lot of ways, I was protected and so are my children. But when I began to realize how vulnerable we now all are to this lack of privacy, it's one thing for an adult, but when you are talking about, you know, something that from the day that you give birth, that child now is being exposed to a world that can use information that you think is benign in a way that's not. And I guess one of the things you did at Harvard was you sort of talked about the do's and don'ts. So I thought that was such a good thing. We only have 20 minutes. I wanted you to talk about what is it that we should be aware of when we start thinking about our children. We want to celebrate their lives and their successes. And at the same time, what kinds of questions should we be asking before we do this? I don't want to shut people down, but I want them to be informed.
I agree completely. And I wrote this book to be a conversation starter as a feature, not a bug of the book. It asks more questions probably than it has answers. One answer that it does give is at the level of a values-based thought compass. And I don't mean thought compass to be sort of cutesy professor speak. I actually mean it in a very concrete way, that the law is only going to get us so far here. And the answer is not very far.
Exactly.
So as we are orienting ourselves quite literally in the digital landscape as parents, teachers, grandparents, aunts, uncles, coaches, you name it, we need to be thinking about the values that root us. And the values that I focus on for a thought compass around sharenting are play, forget, connect, and respect. I look at sharenting, which is now an increasingly used word by the media. The New York Times Privacy Project has been all over it this summer.
Now, did you come up with that word yourself?
I did not. I did not. But I use it differently.
Okay.
So when you see it in the New York Times and other media outlets, it typically refers to how parents post on social media, which is a huge part of sharenting. But I define it much more broadly and much more deeply.
Okay.
I define sharenting as everything that parents, grandparents, educators, coaches, teachers, and other trusted adults do with children's private information through digital technologies. So it's not just social media. It's giving your child a Fitbit. It's using a fertility tracker yourself before your child's even conceived to figure out when is the best time to conceive a child. It's using an Alexa in your home. It's using an educational technology product in a school. So I define it very broadly and very deeply. And the thought compass, this play, forget, connect and respect can orient all of us to creating childhood and adolescent life experiences and spaces that are protected spaces to play, for kids and teens to make mischief, make mistakes, grow up better for having made them, to try to figure out how can we only use digital technologies in a way that supports that, in a way that is not going to leave an indelible digital trail, where we are building meaningful connections either with our kids or for our kids, and when we're respecting their digital capital. Because, of course, you talked about not adopting Facebook. Mm. Well, Facebook makes us pay for their service with data,
right,
even though we don't pay for it with money.
Right.
Given that we can
pay. They mine us.
They do, Arnie. Yeah. And so given that we can pay for it with any type of data, why don't we pay for it with data that isn't about our kids?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just reading an article the other day about how students are being evaluated for getting into college. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they were doing was they were looking at their data and Facebook and social media profile, but they weren't looking at it for the reason that you might think. They were looking at it, well, this child would add to our bottom line because they spend this kind of money on all these things. So it was just so shocking what they were looking at, the gestalt of the child, and it wasn't about academics. You know, and it wasn't about how many social clubs they belong to. It was a bunch of other things that ultimately was helping a college make a decision, but it isn't a decision on whether you'd be successful in philosophy. It was a decision that really sort of played into other needs of that institution, but those needs aren't all academic. A lot of the times they are financial. And I'm thinking, oh my, I was so shocked at that, and then I thought about you and about this book. And here's my challenge to you. And one of the things I said is, so you wanted this to be a conversation starter. I almost think that I want to go into every daycare, and I want to go into every elementary school and every PTA, and I'm trying to think, how do you get this conversation starter with the people that are actually doing the damage when they don't know? And not most of them won't read your book, but they need to understand the kinds of questions and the compass that you suggested. And it is frightening to me because technology is so far ahead of what we understand. And yet, in order for us to protect our children, we have to understand what the technology is doing because we can't protect them effectively. And the last person I want to see hurt my kid is me.
Agree completely. And I have been so overwhelmed by how many folks are interested in having these conversations. Yes. And you're right. It may be that the folks who most need to have them are the least likely to opt in. But I find that I'm being invited into so many different spaces.
Great.
By folks who are very fired up about this. So I'll be doing some events coming up with schools, doing mm-hmm. some events in libraries, doing some events in local theaters, and of course appearing on radio and actually yeah. some TV. And so I do hope that as people continue to engage this conversation, whether it's sparked by my book mm. or by things like a recent New York Times article, the headline of which was "How Photos of Your Kids Are Powering Surveillance Technology."
That's, yes,
right.
Yeah.
So right. Let me. I'm going to ask. I want to get back to the do's and don'ts.
Sure.
I want people to walk away with at least something they can put
Absolutely.
On their refrigerator mm. door. But more importantly, do we value privacy anymore?
Not, and
I have to ask that question because it's not just about Sharon Hood. Right. It really is about that. And I feel like I look at my children and I look at some of the things that people have posted, and in a million years I wouldn't reveal that stuff. But that's my history and my sense of value when it comes to privacy. In a world where we all carry a camera, where we all carry an audio equipment, where we can be attached to people 24/7 because of our cell phones, the idea that there is a place separate from my social media footprint or people's ability to sort of see in or weigh in has really changed, I think, not only how we relate to each other, but I'm just trying to figure out, as you're trying to explain to parents how you need to protect your kids, do they still understand the value of privacy in order to be a child?
Not as well as I think we all should, and I include myself in this, and that's part of why I wrote the book, is a conversation with myself. So I'll tell you how I understand privacy, and then I'm happy to share some do's and don'ts. The way I understand privacy comes from work done by my mentor at Harvard, Jonathan Zittrain. I adopt his definition about privacy is about self-creation, and I'm quoting from him now. He says, privacy is about establishing a locus which we can call our own without undue intervention or interruption, a place where we can vest our identities. And I think somewhat counterintuitively, our children may understand that better than we do because they are, A, they're living this creation of self in a way that may slow down by adulthood, and B, they understand the ins and outs or the do's and don'ts of digital technology better than a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And so what we're starting to see is kids and teens wanting to have a conversation with parents, teachers, and other adults in their lives about, hey, don't do that. And so some do's and don'ts that I have for listeners around sharenting would be, don't ever share pictures of children in any stage of undress. That invites folks who may you know, heaven forbid, but may pull them off the internet and mm-hmm. Photoshop them or otherwise reimage them and make them into pornographic images. Mm-hmm. Don't ever share identifying information that could be used to create any type of false application for a credit product. So I would advise parents not to share full names of children, mm-hmm. locations of birth, dates and times of birth, mm-hmm. because if you combine things like that with social security numbers that are out there from many data breaches, mm-hmm. then it's all too easy for, again, heaven forbid, mm-hmm. the hackers and the criminals out there mm-hmm. to put in applications for credit in a child's name. I encourage parents and teachers and other trusted adults not to use surveillance and tracking technologies unless they truly have no other option. I mm-hmm. think that technology is a gold mine for hackers. Mm-hmm. It's also a gold mine for, as you were talking about earlier, Arnie, we don't have a way of knowing or controlling or fully anticipating what not just the company itself that's taking the data is going to do, but will they sell it to a data broker? What is their affiliate going to do? And what is going to be, you know, that, you know, what is going to be next? And mm-hmm. so that kind of location data is very granular and I think particularly sort of dangerous. I would encourage parents to think about ways to have sharenting conversations with each other and with other caregivers and other relatives. Make it kind of the conversation that you're used to having about, hey, my kid's not allowed to watch R-rated movies. He's only 7.
You know what? I'm thinking about mm-hmm. this is going to sound crazy.
Yeah,
but on the back of an SUV in front of me, my kid is on the honor roll. Okay? Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the back of another SUV. My kid, you know, what is a soccer player, whatever. Mm-hmm. We are, by definition, we want to cavil. You know, we want to mm-hmm. celebrate.
Yes.
We want to say, my son, the doctor. You know, and they're doing that at age, you know, 1. I mean, that's what they do. And so I'm looking at this and I'm feeling so much of it is going to be so hard. Because, you know, as children, we tell them to share. Mm-hmm. Because we see sharing as a good thing. We don't see sharing as a bad thing. And what is so scary to me about Facebook, what's so scary to me about social media, is now sharing is weaponized.
Mm.
And I think that that is going to be a real problem for us. You know, I was on my way to becoming a minister. You know, I remember all the good things I wanted to sort of tell my congregation and all the things that I wanted to teach about caring and sharing and the idea of vulnerability is not a bad thing and the idea of making mistakes is how you learn from them. And there are all these things that are really important life lessons, okay, mm-hmm. that make us better adults and maybe to a large extent a better society because we find out that we're all flawed. So as you wrote this book, how do you then address how do I share but not share? And that is where, and because it's so easy with social media, it's no longer an envelope and a stamp that had so much privacy attached to it. It's now you email, you don't mail. And I'm trying to figure out how do we embrace what is new with what the value was of the past, which is it is important to celebrate these moments. Even the mistakes are important. But how do we do it when nobody uses a stamp and nobody writes a letter and everyone, even children right now, are not being told how to do script. They're being told how to use their iPad. And I challenge you that way because I'm trying to figure out how we're not all losers as we try to protect our children.
Can I speak to that
yeah.
briefly? I was going to say before, I think that one of the big problems in this whole area is an unforeseen intermingling of two very different aspects of the internet. I mean, on the one hand, the internet and social media and everything are – you talk about play, but it's not just play. People having relationships, parents quelling about their children. You know, you sort of use it as a tool that is now a nice part of my life because I can communicate with a lot of people at the right. same time and all this other stuff in the present. But at the same time, it's an archive. And
yes.
it keeps all of this data, every single blessed thing that
right.
you share
right.
in a findable, searchable place, or at least it's searchable by some people, forever. And so how do you tell your kid at the same time, yes, it's good to go out there, be creative, take some risks, you fail, and that's how you learn. And at the same time, when they apply to college or when they apply for a job
right. –
the employer or the college admissions office can go into the archives and find out every single error you made when you were 8 years old.
I think it's a combination of different solution spaces.
Okay.
There is a human solution space where we as parents in particular, but also teachers, grandparents, and so on, mm-hmm. ask ourselves what a lawyer might call a substituted decision-making test. So say to yourself, if the internet had existed, you know, when I was a teenager the way it does now, which for some younger parents that may be true. For most of us, and I include myself on this, it's not true. Would I have been upset at the age of 12 if I suddenly Googled myself and discovered mm-hmm. that my parents had shared pictures of a temper tantrum I had on social media or information about my potty training? Mm-hmm. If the answer is that I, in my adolescent self, would have been dismayed to have had that happen to me, I shouldn't do it to my child, even if the impulse is one to be proud. Oh, my child was potty trained so quickly. She's definitely going to be a doctor. Well, she's not going to want anyone to know when she's 12 or 13 about her potty training. And really, there's no need to connect with others or to share that information in a public-facing way. And you can still share it. You can text it. Mm. You can email it. And I recognize those are sharenting. They're lower risk sharenting because
they're lower risk.
Unless your phone is hacked or the person who gets the text screenshots it and puts it up.
Right. But that's a lot of hoops to go through.
Exactly. So it's lower risk. So we can use lower risk ways to stay connected. The other part of this kind of multifaceted solution space would be legal and regulatory reform.
So that's what I was going to start. But here's the problem. And, you know, as someone who's been a policymaker, as someone who's run for office, I have said to people over and over again that before you ask me about what law I should pass, I'm going to ask you what you have done.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a two-way street. If you think the law is going to protect you, you are wrong. You will have failed, and I will have failed you. So the idea that we constantly knock on the doors of politicians mm-hmm. and of the legal system to protect us is by definition a sign of failure. So I think part of your book really is reminding us about our responsibility, what our job is, what we must do. Yes, you know, I see the legal system as the interstices between the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as holding it together, but that our job is the bulk of it. And it's really hard to explain to parents, in part because we're exhausted, because, you know, we like to put our kids in front of a TV set and say, or whatever, the video, and say, you take care of them. Well, we realize at some point in time that may not be a good thing to do either. And so now, in a lot of ways, we want the ease of social media. We like the fluidity. We like the fact that it's omnipresent. But with that comes a tremendous amount of potential evil. And that means that I have to be aware of that, because the law ultimately won't protect me if I haven't become informed.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that we can also do to empower ourselves is to become increasingly vocal about having sharent safe tools available to us. So, you know, YouTube created YouTube Kids. They didn't do a great job. They just had to pay, you know, hundreds of millions of or tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But there are kid-facing versions of different digital tech products. I'd like to see parent-facing versions.
Thank you.
Of
Thank
digital
you.
Tech
That's
projects.
Exactly mm. right. Yeah. It's exactly right. Leah Plunkett has written the book Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. I'm so glad I'm 66. And then I'm going to just end again with what The New Yorker wrote. Plunkett is describing a set of questions about data and privacy that many of us already grapple with. Yet it all seems particularly nefarious in the context of children for whom a defining condition of life is that they are captive to forces they cannot possibly grasp.
Can I make a suggestion for Leah's next book, which is, I hear you about parents posting stuff about their kids, and we have to be careful. But I think it's also extremely dangerous what kids post themselves, because they think it's cool to post pictures of themselves underage drinking and messing around, whatever they're doing, and doing things that are either illegal or sexist or
so. That's your assignment.
Whatever.
Before you leave.
I will do it.
She's
and,
taking
and
notes.
And they need to know it's going to be around with them until they
All
die.
Right.
Basically.
All right, darling. How do we end this show with what song?
We end appropriately enough with Every Step You Take
and
by the Police, who are aptly named, by the way.
All right, here we go, everyone. Thank you.